Bruce Anderson is one of Canada's leading public affairs and communications professionals. He's worked for prime ministers, premiers, and has led research projects for some of Canada's leading associations, corporations, and nonprofits. He's also my partner at Abacus Data. My name is David Coletto, and welcome back to In Focus. Today, I'm delighted to spend some time talking with Bruce. We have worked together for over 6 years, and he's become both a friend and mentor to me. I have learned so much from him. On this podcast of In Focus, we spend some time talking about public affairs research. Public affairs research represents a good portion of the work we do at Abacus Data. We work with many national associations, corporations, unions, and charities, helping them understand the opinion landscape, measuring and tracking their reputations, and producing content to help them tell their story to government and other stakeholders. I can't think of anyone better to explore this topic with, as he has been one of Canada's best at it for over 3 decades. Today, we let you inside the debates and discussions that Bruce and I often have and give you some perspective on how we approach public opinion research. Enjoy the discussion. So one of the things I've been starting every interview with research professionals is, do you have an overarching philosophy or framework that sets the foundation for how you analyze and explore and measure public opinion? Thinking about, you know, what are the drivers? How do people think? The psychology of it all. Do you have like an anchor that sort of sets the way you approach this stuff?
Well, the question actually made me think about that probably for the first time. So thanks for the question. And, you know, if I started in this business, I didn't start with a theory about it. I started because the opportunity presented itself. And that's kind of, I think, how a lot of people's careers develop, is they kind of stumble into an opportunity. And the next thing you know, they've spent 10 years as a pollster. And after you put in 10 years, why not put in another 20? And the next thing you know, you've been in it for life. So in thinking about that question, David, I've had to kind of go back and kind of say, well, what's different maybe about how I approach it from a lot of the friends and counterparts and competitors that I've met along the way in the business? And I probably think it comes down to a couple of things. One is I grew up in a small town outside of Montreal called Valleyfield. And we are very much a working class family and immersed in, we were kind of Anglophones who learned how to speak French, and we were immersed in different cultures, and we went to an English school, but it was surrounded by a kind of very large French population, very nationalistic French population, one of the first places in the province of Quebec, one of the first 6 seats to send a separatist to the Quebec legislature. And why am I saying all of this? Because my orientation towards polling is to understand how regular people think, rather than to put more emphasis on what academics, no offense intended, because I know that part-time you're an academic, think about how to do public opinion. Obviously, along the way, I learned a number of academic theories about how to do it and follow a lot of the obvious kind of rules of the road in terms of reliability of data and how to collect it. But in terms of designing and analyzing research, I kind of like that guidance that says, if you put something on paper and you imagine showing itself to your high school friends, if they read it, would they look at you like you were foolish, like you didn't speak the same language as them, like you didn't really understand anything about how they live? Because especially in the era of online research, where you don't get that feedback that we used to get occasionally when we were doing phone bank research, where every once in a while we'd have a debrief with the interviewers after they finished a night of calling on an important survey, especially a political one where we're trying to kind of measure the chemistry of voters. And sometimes the interviewers would say, you know, this question here, people didn't really understand it. And they asked me, what do I mean by that? And I had to explain it to them. And I remember very much that as a formative experience, the notion that you had to write questions, not that were dumbed down for people, but they were in language and using ideas that they could relate to in order to understand what they think. And in an online research world, it's so easy to fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. And you and I talk about this all the time in our work. How do we not do that? If you write a question, you hit send, a day later, 1,000 interviews are collected, and you can look at a question afterwards sometimes and go, did they all understand that question the way that I meant it to be understood? And if you're not sure of the answer to that, you can't really analyze the data properly. So I've always kind of been driven by this, start with a pretty good understanding of the language, the lexicon that people can relate to, and probably also with a good understanding of what's on their minds. And so immerse constantly in mm-hmm. other people's surveys, in the conversation that people are having, wherever they're having it. And I, you know, so my background is a little bit more that, obviously, than the academic one. But I've loved the opportunity to kind of blend the two over time.
And it's interesting you say that, because an interview later in the series with a pollster in the US, he said the exact same thing, which is, I start with the question, what's keeping people up at night in the language they use to describe that, and build from there, as opposed to saying, well, there's a theory of public opinion and psychology, and let's start with the theory. I think, and I see that in your work, right? In the way that you approach that, that's really interesting. So over the course of your career, you've watched Canadian public life pretty closely. You've been part of it, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the highlights of the work you've done and some big moments in Canadian history. But over the past 30 years, how do you think public opinion in the country has changed, if at all, over that period?
Well, I think the biggest change is that people don't follow politics, Canadian politics, with the same level of attention that they used to. When I was growing up, again, in this little town that I lived in, I delivered two newspapers, a morning newspaper and an afternoon paper, the Montreal Star and the Gazette. And because there were only a few hundred English families in the town that I lived in, almost everybody got one or the other, sometimes both papers. And if you weren't reading the paper and you were trying to catch news on TV, there were only three channels. So there was a kind of a narrower hose of information. And a lot of that pipe was filled with information about Canadian politics. And so you knew by reading the news coverage and the columns by people like Charles Lynch and Doug Fisher, and literally there might have been five or six other names, but there weren't 500 other names, right, talking about the kind of major events in politics. And over time, as the means of communication diversified and multiplied and people became kind of distracted or interested in a lot of other things and different perspectives, it became harder, I think, for people to follow Canadian politics carefully and be able to really tell the differences between the parties and the individuals. And I remember it was really early in my work in the business, and I think I was doing a piece of research about Canadian communications policy. It was before there were cell phones, that's right. And it was about whether or not federal policy should break down the monopolies in the telephone business and allow competition. So it was before there were any other companies than the state-owned companies. And one of the things that I was trying to do is understand what people thought about the Minister of Communications at the time, who was Francis Fox. And I just had this, to go back to the earlier point, I had this kind of, I really know a lot about this, and I know a lot about him, and I know what he's been saying. And I think the instinct from someone was, let's ask people what they think about what Francis Fox is saying. And I said, well, let's ask if they know who Francis Fox is. So I devised this question where I took Francis Fox's name and a US politician's name and a European politician's name. And then I looked at the guy beside me, a guy named Chris Martin. And I said, I'm going to plug your name in as the fourth name, and I'm going to ask people if they know who the Canadian Communications Minister was. And Chris Martin came a very close second to Francis Fox. And that was a big bell-ringing moment for me. And it kind of started a process where ever after I thought, you know, we're going to meet clients who are going to say, ask them what they think of this thing that we're all super immersed in and that we're all really knowledgeable. And we have all these acronyms to describe. Ask them what they think about that. And my job, more often than not, is to try to find that way to say, well, we can't quite ask them that. And no, we can't do it in three questions. And we need to give you some information that helps you understand the context for the opinions that they might have when we ask the question in a hypothetical manner, because otherwise we're just asking people to give us an answer and they're going to get frustrated with the question. They'll give us an answer, but it won't really mean very much. And as I was thinking about your question about mentoring along the way to this conversation this morning, I remember thinking, you know what, that's really easy for somebody who's 63 years old with 40 years experience in this business to tell somebody who's 23 and who wants to get into the business and to help clients. Yeah, tell your clients they're not thinking clearly. Yeah. And so I get that it's not that easy to do at 23. And I get that I probably didn't do it as much at 23 as I was able to do at 30 and 40 and 53 and so on. But it is still the best approach to this business, in my view, has been to give the best advice you can. And so to help people understand why you're making the case for more questions, more contextual questions, a different approach to asking than maybe they thought about, is still the right thing to do, even if it's a little harder and you have to work at it a little bit more when you're younger.
Yeah, and I think your point about, you know, those in our business, and I say our business, I mean in an official Ottawa business, right? Living in the bubble, in the precinct, is we often are so excited and deeply immersed in this that we think the rest of the country is. And this goes back to your point about over time, people's focus on politics has declined, and it's much easier today to really focus almost entirely on what you love and what you're interested in, whether that be sports or business or art or music, than ever before. And so, you know, in our work together, you've taught me to really focus in on a subset of the population, right? That group that you termed involved Canadians, those that consume much more news about public affairs, those that might participate, whether that's not just voting, but, you know, maybe they're activists, maybe they're just community members, maybe they just like to talk about this stuff, right? Those influencers. Why is that group in particular today the most important to understanding the dynamics of broader public opinion? And why should we, in a way, isolate them and learn more about them than the general public, which often we probably pay too much of attention to?
Yeah, well, that's a really, you know, it's a really good question. I think that when I started out, the prevailing wisdom taught by the social scientists was, if you want to know how young people are going to vote, just ask how their parents vote. And if you want to know how women are going to vote, ask how their husbands are going to vote. And as weird as that sounds today, there was some scientific basis for making that case in the 70s or late 60s, let's say. And it wasn't long before I started to explore, well, what if it's actually turning not just, what if that's not just evaporating as a phenomenon? What if there's a reverse phenomena that's emerging, that young people are having more influence on older people and women are having more influence on men, which I would make a case is absolutely true now. So it's not as though there are no intergenerational or intergender influences. It's that the historical ones have been reversed. And you see it on a lot of issues of social change, environmental questions of climate change. So I become fascinated with the idea of influencers even before there was a term called influencers and an Instagram and a Twitter and all of that. And so probably about 10 years ago, I started to recognize that in our research, a lot of people had very little opinion about a lot of national issues. Back to the, you know, they're not paying as much attention because they're paying attention to other things. And so in effect, if we were asking 1,000 people and 700 of them really didn't know what we were talking about, a constitutional accord being a decent example. And the other 30% had a lot to say, had a lot of thoughts, and actually were the people in their families, in their neighborhoods, in their communities, in the local coffee shops or the arenas, who were telling others, this is what I think, this is what you should think too, then let's at least overweight our understanding mm-hmm. those people, not in the published data, but in terms of helping our clients understand the dynamics. And that became a pretty good way of figuring out on critical issues where there was going to be a heightened debate, which direction where they were going to go in. It's never perfect because debate will actually kind of persuade people one way or the other. But on an issue like Canada-US free trade, for example, I was able to see that those involved Canadians were inclined to think that Canada could win at free trade mm-hmm. with the United States before everybody else was, and that was probably going to be the prevailing argument. And on the Constitutional Accord, they were the ones who were saying, you know what, this deal to give Quebec this in exchange for that doesn't feel right, and we're probably not going to go along with it. And so that's a very useful thing. But ultimately, if we fast forward to today, we know that there is another version of influencer going on. It's shortened in terms of sometimes it's just a picture on Instagram posted by somebody with a meme that says something in a very powerful, persuasive way. Mm-hmm. And we know that that has a ripple effect on opinion. And so I see as wanting to continue down the road of monitoring those things that help us understand the direction of the puck, to use the Canadian metaphor that we're also familiar with.
I mean, I think we're also, you know, you're a communicator. I always think you're a communicator first, then and you use data to guide that. You're just so focused on that. What role do you think the rise of misinformation, disinformation is playing in that process? Because it seems to me there's this new variable that we can't easily unpack. And that is what might normally have been, you know, when I go to a family dinner, because I'm in Ottawa and because I studied politics, everyone says, hey, David, you know, what do you think? I'm that involved Canadian that you just described often at my family dinner table. But now when I go to family dinners pre-COVID, I find myself competing with misinformation that my family members are spouting out. And so it, in a way, you know, there's this new variable in all of that. How do you as a researcher unpack that in some of the work that you do?
Well, I think I have an answer as a researcher and an answer as a citizen. As a researcher, I think we need to be really aware of how misinformation accumulates and acts as a bonding agent between people who share a common set of grievances, a common worldview. I remember, I think it was about 2 years ago, we did a piece of work where we were able to kind of explore how common it was to find somebody who didn't believe the climate was changing, who thought homosexuality was a choice, who thought that women were getting too much power these days, and who thought Canada would be better off if it was more white. And that's not really about misinformation. Mm-hmm. That is about people having a sense of grievance that is stoked. And so I don't think that the starting point is somebody says, let's confuse people. I think the starting point is let's find the grievance and worry it and, you know, create that reaction. And I've been fascinated by this idea that it isn't some evil guiding hand out there that's causing this to happen, but rather it's the byproduct of technology and algorithms in the hands of businesses that are designed to do certain things for those businesses, not in an immoral way, but in an amoral way. In other words, if your business model is to get people to react, because the more that people react, the more they'll see the ad that you're trying to share with them, the more data you'll get that makes them valuable as a customer that you can sell to the next advertiser. And if you build your algorithms to produce the reaction, you're going to end up finding those things that inflame people, that amaze them, that excite them, that disturb them, that worry them. And disproportionately, those things that have that negative reaction. And I think that's where we're at now. I think the algorithms are doing what they're built to do, and that the effect of that is to create these communities of people who share information that feeds a particular set of grievances. And then you get a politician who's opportunistic and says, I can spot that a mile away. I can speak its language. I can profit from it. So where does that take me? It takes me to a place where I think, you know, there's two, I follow this debate a lot. And I find some people are saying, you know, we just need to try harder to understand the people who have these misinformed views. And I kind of get that on a humanistic level, but on another level, I kind of think, no, actually, I think we need to stamp that out. I think we need to put the guardrails up on our democracies and on our societies again. And in a conversation that Peter Mansbridge and I had with Ian Bremner the other day, he was a really interesting guy, runs the Eurasia Group. I think he put it this way. He said, there are two types of media. There's the traditional media and their business model is failing and it's likely to completely fail. And then there's the new media platforms, and the business model of those is not journalism. It's something completely different. And so they're going to replace journalism, but replace it with something that is ungoverned right now in terms of its effect on our literacy, our knowledge, and our cohesion as a society. So can we really trust those companies to solve for that? It's actually against their fiduciary responsibility to do some of the things that they would need to do. So we can't probably trust, and that takes you inevitably to a place as awkward and as uncomfortable as it is, where governments are going to need to regulate this stuff. And I see that being a profound political challenge, but I also see it as an unavoidable thing that we have to do something about, because it's very, very, very worrying the direction that we're going in. That's as a citizen. As a researcher, I think we need to make sure that we understand that if people say, well, I think this on X, we need to be able to help our clients understand whether that position is an artifact of a worldview and misinformation, as opposed to somebody who's, you know, kind of consumed both arguments, thought them through, and arrived at point Y.
So let's talk a little bit about that as we end off the podcast, because you know, research and public affairs, I think, has always been tied together. Maybe you could give your perspective or your pitch on the value that the work we do plays for those, you know, in public affairs and advocacy and government relations specifically. On the other, not on the side of government, because we can talk a lot about the value of research from a policy making perspective, but I'm curious your view on a policy influencing perspective. What role does polling and public opinion play in that?
I think there's three roles. I think the first one is, how do we reach people? I think we've used research in our business a lot to help our colleagues at Spark Advocacy and other places figure out exactly how to reach people where they are, to join the conversation that they are having, rather than to presume that we can wave our hands and they'll all come and join our conversation. So targeting is extremely important, and research is hugely helpful. The second is how to get their attention. Because it's one thing to kind of know where they are and to try to insert yourself into the conversation they're having. It's quite another for them to turn their head towards you and say that again. I'd like to know more about that. And so research has helped us a lot in designing advertising that in 7 words or less, and with a little bit of moving imagery and a kind of a pithy invitation to listen to our point of view. Research helps separate the wheat from the chaff, helps refine the good ideas into the great ideas, and it's enormously valuable. And in fact, online research is especially good that way, because we can actually show people things, as opposed to some of the earlier experiences I've had where you had to describe, what if you saw an ad that looked like this over the phone, and expect people to give you a kind of a sense of how they would emotionally react. And then the third thing is how do you kind of persuade people? And I say persuade because really the outcome that you're looking for is to have something change as a result of your communication. But I don't mean persuade in a nefarious sense. I just mean you've got a point of view that you're trying to get people to kind of think about and adopt. And And that comes down to how to come up with ideas for language, for making a point. And language can be visual, it can be oral, it can be verb, you know, it can be written. But how to come up with that way of making the point that will make people go, that's a good point, I remember that. And so it's reach, it's attention grabbing or stopping power, and then it's persuasiveness. And our research has been extremely useful in helping our clients do that. And it's the part that I probably have the most enjoyment with right now. Yesterday, we saw a client, one of our clients, the BC Council of Forest Industries, roll out a new campaign that we built for them called Grow, Use, and Repeat, about using BC forest products. And we got them to wrap these four trains that run from the Vancouver airport to downtown Vancouver, which is a great way to move an argument or an idea through a city over a protracted period of time. So lots of people will get to see it. And I just love using research to help design ideas like that. And we test that kind of thing all the time, as you know, and people sometimes are very good at helping us go, not that color, but this color, or that word doesn't quite work for me. What about a different word? And I find that I'm endlessly curious about how to use research in those three ways.
It comes back to your, you know, again, you're a communicator. You want to figure out how to spark that light bulb in people's heads and say, ah, that's something I haven't thought of. Or you've kind of, sometimes you want to punch them in the face, not literally, but punch them in the face. And sometimes you want them to subtly get there. It's so, I don't want you to give away all the trade secrets here, but I think, you know, one of the things in this course specifically that I'm trying to help students understand is how to help a client who comes to you and says, I have a problem, or I want a certain outcome, whether that's a policy or I've got a reputational issue. How do you approach, you know, the work you do with a client when you first meet them or you're first getting to know them? Do you have a process that you typically follow that you found to be particularly successful over time?
Yeah, I think probably a couple of things come to mind. One is that clients often come with a tactic rather than a strategy or an outcome. And a lot of people kind of use those words in different ways. But for me, the right starting point is what needs to be different as a result of what we're going to do together, whether it's research or a communications plan or a combination of the two. What is it that you're trying to accomplish that is a change from the status quo? And that's a really important step in the process, because the clients often have kind of skipped forward from that in their own internal kind of conversation or dynamic. That's already clear. But it's important to kind of ground any public affairs work in the what are we actually trying to do. And so I find that a very useful thing. The second thing is a lot of clients are so immersed in the work that they're doing and the community in which they operate, their cohorts at work and the issues that preoccupy them. Whereas you or I, we're kind of seeing a wide breadth of context. We gather a lot of data all the time. We work for a lot of different clients. We kind of absorb politics and news coverage constantly. And so we sort of take that contextual understanding for granted sometimes. But often clients really benefit when you start a conversation with them by saying, look, when you tell me this, here's what it sounds like to me based on the context as I see it. And then you run through a few important thoughts about, well, this is the dynamic between these generations, and this is the way in which kind of East-West tensions are. And right now we know that, you know, only 40% of people are convinced that capitalism is good for them. And, you know, important contextual indicators like that often open a client's eyes up to the importance of, actually, let's get the research right and let's be really kind of open-minded as a starting point in terms of what communications might follow. So context and outcome, those are the two things that I always try to drive home in an early conversation, because if nothing else, the client will walk away from that conversation going, I learned something and I got some important advice about how to make my dollars that I'm going to spend on this piece of activity go further.
I think there's a lesson there for everybody, students and non-students, is that, you know, and there's that book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. I think pollsters, researchers are the ultimate generalists. Like I always say, one of the most, the best things about my job is I learn about something new almost every single day, right? Like whether we're talking about forestry or banking or health, right? Like we have to become not quite experts on everything, but pretty close in order to be able to communicate and write questions and understand their world and connect it to everybody's world. That's really
this
what we're...
This is literally the luckiest thing for me. I am not an expert in anything. Maybe a little bit. I can tell people about Scottish golf courses. But other than that, I am purpose-built to be a generalist. And I feel like I've found my way into a professional life that is purpose-built for the generalist. And it allows me to graze across any number of subjects all the time. Today, I'm going to be talking about vaccination hesitancy and cultural policy and four or five other things. And in between, I will walk my dog at the golf course. But that aspect of it is what keeps me coming back to it year after year after year and working with younger people like yourself who have the same fascination with it and are just really great people to work with.
Well, I could spend another half an hour more talking with you and getting at, maybe we'll have to do this again in the future. But I do want to say that, you know, I got to know you before we worked together when you were a member of the At Issue panel and, you know, tuning in every Thursday to see how you viewed the world and just the way you brought, I think, you know, that context, right? That context was so important. So for listeners, if you enjoyed this chat, I highly recommend you listen to Bruce and Peter Mansbridge. They've got, I guess, a podcast and a podcast, as you call it, Smoke, Mirrors, and the Truth. It's going to be it was an interesting few months as you sort of unpacked the Trump world. Now you sort of, thankfully, we can pivot and look at some broader things. So Bruce, thanks so much for your time today. And, you know, as I always say, it's been a pleasure just to know you and to have you teach me every day. So thanks for sharing a few minutes with everybody else.
Pleasure's all mine, David. Thanks for doing this.